It's The Wonky Show. We're talking Brexit, free speech, UCAS data, an OFS bonanza, and more.
That's a real issue. That is something which we should all be concerned about. My own personal view is that we should be absolutely resolute in defending the right of people to speak out against other countries' governments if they want to, and we shouldn't necessarily be bound by extraterritorial laws on it. And it is a shame that it does get bound up in the same broad bucket as whether... you know, whether students can clap or boo Toby Young.
Welcome to The Wonky Show, your direct way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm Wonky's Editor-in-Chief, Mark Leach, and it's the end of the season and the last show of the year, but there's one final roll of the policy dice. And to do it, I'm joined by three fabulous guests. In London, we have Jonathan Simons, Director and Head of the Education Practice at Public First. Jonathan, your highlight of the week, please.
I think my highlight of the week is undoubtedly that it is the last week of the working year, and I'm looking very much forward to Christmas.
And also in London, we have Vivian Stern, Director of Universities UK International. Vivian, your highlight of the week, please.
It's going to be Friday afternoon. It really, really is. But I had the world's saddest Christmas party this week. I had a couple of neighbours come round for very cold mulled wine and very hot mince pies in our front garden, and it was dismal.
And in Watford, we have Jim Dickinson, known to you and I as Wonky's Associate Editor. Jim, your highlight of the week, please.
Yeah, well, mine's quite sort of kind of nerdy and worky, but my highlight was watching Oliver Dowden this week make actually what I thought was a really helpful and balanced contribution into this kind of wider set of freedom of speech and culture wars debates, when he actually said that it was possible that there could be harms that could come for adults from nevertheless legal speech online, which is in marked contrast to lots of the other contributions we get in this debate.
Niche. And let's start the week with the big story dominating the headlines. It's Brexit. And at the time of recording, looks like we're edging towards a deal. Vivian, what's going on?
Oh, who knows? I've been determined not to ride the roller coaster on this deal, no deal thing, because I've been there before. Last October, just before the 31st of October and threatened no deal, I got to a point where I felt actually ill for a week. You know, I had kind of proper anxiety attacks over no deal. So I'm determined not to get my knickers in a twist over whether there's going to be an agreement or not. I think that we have a pretty good idea what would happen in both scenarios. I think we've done everything we can to prepare for both scenarios. So, you know, then I think you just have to sit tight and wait. But if I had to put money on it, I'd say there would be a deal. And I think that this is just one gigantic game of chicken. And what was happening at the weekend was just the latest and most probably predictable step in that game of chicken.
And I mean, the issues for the sector haven't really changed since the referendum itself. But there's lots of concern earlier this week about Erasmus Plus. What can you say about where that's got to?
Well, I think there was a briefing which Barnier gave to EU ambassadors, which Politico picked up, and they were told by somebody who was in the room that Barnier had said that the negotiation on Erasmus had concluded and that there was no agreement in that area, so that the UK would not be in the next programme. UK side folk are saying that's not their view of the situation and that negotiations are ongoing. So, you know, again, who knows? But I wouldn't be tremendously surprised if the end result of the negotiations, whether there's a deal or not, is the UK dropping out of the Erasmus programme. I wouldn't be terribly surprised about that.
Yeah. I mean, Jonathan, how high up on the roster of kind of lines and negotiating points is higher education stuff? So when I think about Erasmus Plus or the access to the research programmes, things like that, the government say that those things are important to them, but it doesn't, you know, are they going to go to the wall on them in the way they are going to on fishery, for example?
No, not in the slightest, I'm afraid. It's well down the list. You know, the things that are really driving the UK negotiating position are what's called the level playing field, essentially the way in which the UK and the EU can or cannot diverge from each other over time. And then there are a few very, very politically salient issues, of which fish is one, largely because of its importance in Scotland, and also its sort of totemic importance to a lot of the people who voted leave. And I'm afraid particularly given the vast amount of economic contribution, apart from anything else, higher education makes to this country, it is probably very much a make weight in negotiations. So I suspect Vivian is right. If it smooths the deal quite easily, you could see the UK dropping out of a lot of HE collaboration.
Yeah, well, I think I'm never going to not be angry about Brexit.
Yeah, can I add one thing, an additional thing to be angry about? Like, whose bright idea was it to have a transition period ending on the 31st of December? Because, you know, as we have discussed, we're quite looking forward to a break, and some bright spark didn't really think this through. So that is also another reason to be angry.
Jim, do you want to say anything about Brexit? Or
Viv, can I just check, is this settlement scheme problem still a problem in terms of EU students that haven't made it here yet?
Well, I mean, I think the students who come here before the 31st and apply for pre-settled status are, you know, they get covered by the withdrawal agreements. So those students who get here before the 31st have, you know, huge advantages over those who arrive on the 1st of January. Now, of course, there are students who might otherwise have come to the UK who won't do because of the pandemic. But I mean, you know, I think that's, it's just yet another adverse impact of the pandemic.
And am I right that at least would be possible for the government to adapt and extend the terms of the settlement scheme to kind of fix this little problem, right?
Well, I think it would be possible, but I don't think they're going to do it. I don't know what Jonathan's view is, but I think that's just sort of, you know, that's the way the cookie has in fact crumbled.
Yeah, that's exactly right. They could amend it. They could do, you know, given that the EU side has no great desire to close off freedom of movement and settlement, it's entirely within the UK's gift to do so, and it wouldn't necessarily cost them anything, but they're not going to do it.
Well, that's grim.
Great.
Can I say something positive, though, on this? I mean,
hold on, Mark. I'm going to have to insert a sound effect here.
Everybody knows I'm a wee bit kind of, you know, I'm a bit a glass half full, so apologies for this. But I remember vividly standing in my kitchen about 2 years ago and getting, I was reading an email from somebody who just had a conversation with an official in the DfE, and the penny dropped. If we didn't get Erasmus, there would be nothing, right? And I stood there in my kitchen thinking, hang on a second, what do you mean nothing? And at that moment, we launched a great big campaign called hashtag support study abroad. It's possibly not the snappiest title we ever came up with. The fact is, in the spending review, whenever it was, it's either 6 years ago or last week, the government said that they would fund a programme to support higher education outward mobility in the middle of a massive economic crisis. So I will not be crying into my beer. I will try to think about the opportunity that is ahead of us. I know that that's probably a little bit, I mean, I've been accused more than once of sounding Johnsonian about this, but there is a new national scheme that will be launched if we're out on Erasmus, and it's our job to make that work.
Today's students have access to opportunities, tools and technologies that no generation has ever had, but they also face a deeply uncertain future. The pandemic, digital disruption, widening social inequality, and a hugely challenging labour market. Universities aspire to prepare students with the knowledge, skills and behaviours that will enable them to thrive as professionals and citizens in a world that's constantly evolving. And students are looking to understand how to mobilise their knowledge to make an impact and shape the future of their profession and their community. So join us on 12th of January for a Wonky at Home event in partnership with Adobe, where we'll explore which skills, competencies and mindsets best enable students to succeed, and how they can be made tangible in the curriculum. We'll hear insights from students and academics on the skills students need to thrive, and we'll consider whether the current political framing of the value and quality of university courses really captures universities' own aspirations for their graduates. That's Skills to Thrive, 12th of January. Book now at wonky.com/events.
Right, the free speech rankings are back. Jim, what is going on?
Oh, my days. So I woke up this morning in actually quite a good mood because, you know, we've got our team meeting today and I'm, you know, a guest on the podcast rather than having to host it. And, you know, it's, oh, what a great day. And then I realised that from nowhere, or at least not from anywhere that I'd got my eye on, the free speech rankings are back. So those people that have been around for a few years now will remember that the Revolutionary Communist Party and or Living Marxism and or its current kind of digital native iteration spiked for a while in the latter part of the decade was running something called the Free Speech University Rankings, which was an exercise in looking at press coverage of kind of, you know, snowflake students multiplied by some analysis of university and students' union free speech and harassment policies, and that would generate a red, amber, green rating for a university. And this would get coverage, you know, would come out every February and would get lots of coverage and, you know, was evidence of a big clampdown on free speech and so on. And then it disappeared. So what it looks like they sort of ran out of money for someone to kind of trawl through all the policies. But it's kind of made this reappearance through the think tank Civitas, which is an offshoot of the Institute for Economic Affairs. And so, yeah, so it's made this reappearance, and it's basically taken the technique that it had when Spikes were running it, and then we kind of multiplied it. So, it, I mean, for example, if you're a university where some students have heckled Toby Young, you pick up points. And if, for example, you've mentioned 18 different sorts of discrimination in your harassment policy, you pick up 18 points. So there are some methodological issues in it. But I guess, you know, the extraordinary thing is, and the thing that I find really exhausting about it is, I think lots of people will know that I have been doing my level best to lean in to some of this free speech stuff over the past few months. I've been supporting a group of students' unions that are trying to take the debate seriously and trying to understand the real tensions that are there on campus between freedom from harm and freedom to speak, the sort that, as I said earlier, Oliver Dowden was referring to in relation to online harms the other day. This is not an exercise in examining that. This is an exercise in trying to create some science out of a load of fairly partisan press coverage to make a fairly partisan point. So it's not helpful. It's just exhausting.
Jonathan, why does this agenda never die?
Well, partly because the people that it is designed to irritate on this podcast get irritated by it. Partly because the people who are designed to be galvanized by it continue to get galvanized by it. And partly, in all seriousness, because although many listeners to this podcast will disagree, partly because there is a serious point lurking beneath all of the slightly shonky methodology and slightly odd spreadsheets that Civitas produce. The honest answer is because it is quite easy for a researcher to do something like this. It doesn't cost very much money. You have to pay somebody to sit there and trawl through various things. This is the beauty of everything being online, is that actually, if you want to, you can come up with something fairly easily. And we had a similar thing the other week. There's another similar micro group called the Campaign for Common Sense. Did something on comedy and the fact that all comedians booked by the BBC are all completely left-wing as well. So, you know, the right are in favour of free speech occasionally, except when it's all left-wing comedians, when they instantly wanted the BBC to have diversity quotas for right-wing comedians, which, as far as I can work out, would mean that Jeff Norcott is the only person ever booked on Have I Got News For You. And Lee Hurst, there's one for the older ones, if you can remember Lee Hurst from 90s comedy days. But, I mean, this is, you know, we can laugh about it because it's Christmas and the like, but when we do get back to proper work in January, you know, there is likely to be a potential serious push on this agenda again. But I suspect that when we come back to look at the legislative annals of time, the Civitas report will not be footnoted extensively.
Vivian, you spend a lot of time speaking to universities. I mean, how high on their agenda do you think this free speech issue is? Or is it just happening in right-wing think tanks and the right-wing press?
No, I think, I mean, it has to be quite high on people's list of things to think about, because it's become a real boiling point in terms of public perceptions of universities. And I think that's that. I know a lot of people in senior positions in universities just feel a bit. I mean, Jim's sort of exhausted point sort of strikes home. People just a little bit exhausted by this sort of constant barrage of hostile rhetoric about university, the culture in universities, and you know, of course, the whole sort of value debate. But it is, I mean, nonetheless, I think that despite the frustrations of going around this block, and actually things which seem to me to be indicators of a campus where there is a good and vibrant culture of free speech and challenge, there are some really significant issues sitting underneath it that aren't simple to solve. I mean, the bit that I find myself thinking and talking about a lot is to do with effectively international politics and how it plays out on campus. And some of that is a little bit pointy, you know, not at all easy to deal with. I mean, the current issue, which we're trying to wrap our heads around and work out what to be, you know, how we could possibly be useful, is how to deal with the implications of the Hong Kong security law for the activities of students who are studying in the UK. It's not nothing. There is something really difficult for universities to navigate there.
I think Vivian's completely right. And actually, in a sense, it's a shame that reports like this can trivialise it, because you're exactly right. The issue to do with Hong Kong and dissident students and the like is deeply, deeply important. And I think, you know, universities are placed in a very, very difficult position here, and they are under, you know, legal jeopardy as well as sort of student welfare and pastoral jeopardy. That's a real issue. That is something which we should all be concerned about. My own personal view is that we should be absolutely resolute in defending the right of people to speak out against other countries' governments if they want to, and we shouldn't necessarily be bound by extraterritorial laws on it. And it is a shame that it does get bound up in the same broad bucket as whether you know, whether students can clap or boo Toby Young, which, frankly, from my perspective, you should be given an automatic first if you do.
I wouldn't want to go to university that didn't, or have a day every week where we could all line up and boo Toby Young.
But I mean, look, it's funny that kind of mention this stuff about you know, autocratic regimes. So we've just done this kind of call for evidence to support this group of student unions that are trying to lean into this issue and take it seriously. And that is an issue. Student unions are struggling with that, particularly in the space of, you know, kind of trying to support student societies. But the other thing we've just found out, you know, I've got 61 responses in so far from student unions about last academic year, and there were 6 cancellations of events. 4 were people not getting their forms in on time. 1 was a pyramid scheme expert who'd spent some time, who'd been convicted of some, crimes as a result of this, that was trying to speak at an entrepreneur society event, and the students' union kind of clocked it. And then the other one was, Jeremy Corbyn, because the party had phoned up and said, can we have a rally on campus tomorrow? And a clubs and societies manager said, well, you will have to fill in a form and it will take 7 days. So the party said, well, forget that, we'll do it in town. So, you know, I mean, look, I've no doubt that there are real potential issues about the sort of chilling effect of what people think campus is like. But, you know, I'm worried it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. And that's partly because what I can absolutely guarantee is, this time last year, the government had just been elected, 3 or 4 weeks after student unions across the country will have been running hustings events, where lots and lots of Conservative prospective party candidates, UKIP candidates, Brexit party candidates, they will all have been turning up, taking part in debates facilitated by student union officers and staff that are desperate to make sure that students have a proper say in the political process. So my real worry about this stuff is that the self-fulfilling prophecy of this kind of stuff makes right-wing speakers believe that there's a problem, and then either, you know, they don't pursue coming onto campus, or come onto campus assuming that campus is going to be hostile, and nothing could be further from the truth most of the time.
And now for a musical interlude.
Now that they've closed the student travel window and the HESIS returns are complete, this horrible year that has brought us such fear is a year we don't want to repeat. All we want is the peer review for Christmas. A Christmas report by a dame. Wanna read the Pierce Review this Christmas? I can tell you with no sense of shame. Please release the Pierce Review for Christmas. It's so robust and it's never been seen. Wait for the peer's review this Christmas. It's been delayed since back in 2019. A new style of test leaves us quite out of breath. The metrics so electric will shine. Year is not quite done. So please give us our fun. Hit our benchmarks on this Christmas time. We want to see the Biz Review for Christmas 2020 has been oh so bleak. Gavin, bring us Biz Review this Christmas. Come on, Michelle, give us a peek. Play before both houses now. That's what I'm talking about. Oh yeah. Let's see your tech responses.
Now, this week we've had UCAS end of cycle data and a clearer picture of what's happened in the application cycle just gone. Jonathan, talk us through it.
Well, it's good news is the short answer. And there was obviously a lot of panic in the higher education sector this summer just gone with the cancellation of exams and the awarding of what were called these centre-assessed grades, which were felt to be significantly inflated on what young people would have gotten their A-levels. And there was a feeling that essentially the government passed the buck to universities when they decided not to run A-levels and instead to not use the algorithm and instead to just allow their centre-assessed grades. The view was that, well, this is going to lead to a significant increase in young people getting higher A-level grades. That's going to mean that universities have over-offered and will be stuck with additional places. And government's view was more or less, well, fine, but you deal with that. Not our problem anymore now, not our political problem. And so there was a panic as to what it would mean. But essentially what the end of cycle data shows is that it's been managed pretty well. So applications are up, acceptances are up, international student numbers, which again we were very, very worried about, have more or less held up. There has been a surge of A-level increases. We did see a significant increase in sort of overall A-level pass rates go up. But actually, and indeed the wonky site talks about this, the predictions were actually more accurate than people had thought. There's always an issue, one of the arguments for post-qualification admissions is that predictions are felt to be inaccurate. Actually, particularly at the kind of more affluent and least affluent student end, the sort of polar quintiles 1 and 5, the predictions, teacher predictions, more or less held up, not so much in the middle. And so what have we seen? Well, we've seen a sort of, you know, record number of surge of young people going to university, actually a surge of older people going to university, particularly we think around medicine and nursing, all of which is good news. I suppose two pieces of, well, not bad news, but two pieces of unknown news to think about. One is that we don't know if these people will stay. And it's fairly safe to say that a lot of first years have had a difficult time of it this term for various reasons which may have been picked up. So we don't know about whether they'll stay and what the retention issues are. And the second thing is, of course, is we're already thinking about next summer. And the government is very, very clear that A-levels are going to continue and level 3, BTECs and the like, but they were very clear last year as well. I think the more realistic worry is how will the system deal with some young people who have been out of school for a considerable period of time. We've been doing a lot of work at Public First about this, and there are some areas of the country and some schools where attendance is 50%, 60%, 70%. We pick up a lot of parents in our focus groups saying that their kids have been out of school pretty much at least half of this term. Now, if that continues, or certainly if it continues for a decent chunk of the Easter term up until Easter, you will have young people sitting their A-levels who have lost, you know, most of year 12 and probably about half of year 13. Now, how you account for that in the exam system is as yet the big unanswered question. The government's solution to this is that it set up a task force to look at it, which is in no way kicking the can down the road. And we wait to see what that task force is going to come up with, but it is a real issue for universities because it will ultimately be up to them to decide how they treat young people with very, very significant amounts of learning loss.
And Vivian, I mean, on the university end, although the positive national picture, there have been big winners and losers. We haven't got the by provider data of this yet, but the last minute changes with the CAGs towards the end of the kind of exam, the shambles, meant that some universities were able to suck in a lot of applicants,
yeah,
at the expense of others.
Yeah, I mean, I think, as you say, we're not quite sure how this will sort of work out when the sort of pattern across providers becomes a little clearer. But it's clear that, as you say, there have been big winners and losers, and that has significant financial implications for some institutions. And it's repeated on the international side. We did do a little enrollment survey a couple of weeks ago to try and work out where international numbers would end up. And the headlines, of course, you know, UCAS doesn't deal with all international applications, but the sort of picture they're reporting aligns with what we've heard from institutions. So UCAS data shows a 17% increase in non-EU acceptances, 2% increase in EU. And when we look at what providers are telling us, what universities are telling us, there's a kind of 50-50 split. So 50% have seen growth, 50% have seen reductions. We're not quite sure of the magnitude of those. And probably some of the institutions who've lost numbers are dealing with quite small international intakes. 25% of institutions were reporting, you know, some in their terms anyway, significant increases. So there's obviously been quite a kind of divergence of fortunes this year, and I think we just have to wait and see what the consequences on financial stability will be for some institutions that might have struggled a bit.
And on international, Vivian, the I mean, what's the mood out there? So I mean, particularly thinking about international students that will be coming in January. I know that the UK's reputation suffered in the early response to the pandemic, although that didn't translate too badly in the numbers. But what's your sense of how UKHE is faring up in all this?
I think it's the position is really good. I mean, first of all, I think although the UK is regarded by international prospective international students as having managed the pandemic rather poorly compared to the other destinations that attract international students. I mean, we sort of bump along with the US in terms of management of the pandemic. When it comes to the way that we've treated international students, the UK does conspicuously well. And I think the reasons for that are pretty clear. So the government has bent over backwards to make sure that international student interests are taken into consideration, including through the visa system. And we've got, you know, the introduction of the graduate route, which was announced in September and will go live this summer, has been a fantastic help to us in what would otherwise be a difficult year. And then I think the final thing is you have to look at where else students would have gone. So the US has been sort of decreasingly popular for reasons mostly associated with Trump's policies. But Australia and Canada have got closed borders. So whilst I think my understanding is that Canada has done pretty well with enrolling students who are studying fully online out of Canada, Australia, I think, has had a more difficult time.
Yes, as you say, pretty much closed for business. Jim, Jonathan mentioned the issue of retention. You've been doing a lot of work on that this term, and we've done some actual hard research. Talk us through what the latest numbers we've seen.
There's a really interesting question that kind of relates to, you know, I mean, are students going to drop out? Probably not if we look at most of the numbers. And that's probably related to the reason why applications are holding up, which is partly about, you know, people are still aspirational, people still are attracted to higher education, but also because there's nothing else to do. We're in the middle of what looks like a very dramatic recession and so on and so on. And we know that people flock to education in those circumstances. But I mean, the other thing that I think is really interesting about the research we've been doing is that whilst there's no evidence that people are about to drop out en masse, they have had a really rough time. And, you know, Jonathan was talking about learning loss at, you know, for in schools for, you know, at post 16, if and well, right across the school system, but certainly at post 16. And that's obviously something we're worried about in relation to entry into university. But whilst there's no, you know, you wouldn't necessarily say that the disruption and the learning loss has been as dramatic for higher education students, there's probably no doubt, and certainly looking at the research we've done, there's no doubt that there's been some disruption and been some learning loss in higher education. Now, you know, effectively, the solutions that DfE have put on the table for A-level students so far are versions of the sorts of no detriment policies that we were seeing in higher education earlier on in the year. And, you know, the right response, therefore, is to make some structural adjustments for students that have been struggling this term through no fault of their own, but certainly not to drag down the people who've done better this term through no fault of their own. Now, where that leads you to at post-16 is baking in grade inflation. The thing about Gavin Williamson's announcement a couple of weeks ago is that he's effectively saying he's not going to try and drag the algorithm down in a scenario like this where you have to correct for the people doing worse than usual through no fault of their own. You have to bake in some grade inflation. What's fascinating is we've not heard that debate yet in higher education. No one is really talking about the potential that there's been significant disruption and learning loss for HE students this term. No one's really talking about the need for OFS to signal that it will accept a level of grade inflation this year as a result of these things that have happened. And, you know, from my perspective, that becomes disproportionately important because what you really want in January is a proper interrogation of how HE students have done this term in the same way that Gavin Williamson has called a task force to interrogate how post-16 students are doing so far this year so that we can make adjustments.
It's a really good point you make, Jim, and I wonder actually whether one of the differences might be that all 16 to 18 year olds, and obviously there are post-18 year olds that go to university, but all 16 to 18 year olds currently sitting their level 3 exams, they're all sitting the same exam, or at least the same exams nationally. They're either sitting an A-level or a BTEC or whatever, but there's differential learning loss within people sitting the same qualification. Whereas within an HE institution, you could argue, broadly speaking, everybody at the University of X has had more or less a common experience. So given that it's within the realms of the University of X to award those degrees, do you see what I mean? You don't have a kind of a within institution issue in the same way that you do have within A-levels.
But you still have the regulatory issue that OFS is going to come and say, hold on a second, what's happening here with grade inflation? Because, you know, I'm old enough to remember when Gavin Williamson was kind of allergic to grade inflation, and was, you know, instructing every part of the education system to crack down on it, even where, you know, our data show that often cases didn't really exist.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I completely take that point, and you're right. You do have to get some signal from the OFS that actually, if as a University of X, you do award more firsts or more 2-1s this year, that has to be recognised. And what we can't have is another round of the, in fact, we had the grade inflation data come out quite recently as well, and again, a big discussion about what this unexplained nature of it is. So yes, I think there is something there that universities need to be careful that they don't leave themselves exposed to when that issue comes around again.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, There's got to be some kind of national or international agreement that, you know, pretty much every data set that covers literally anything in the entire world is going to look wrong in 2020 because of the pandemic. It's like, it's either going to go massively up or massively down, depending on what the measure is. You know, and that, you know, look at league tables, you look at literally anything in HE, you look at all the data that comes out of it. Everything is wrong. Everything is skew-whiff. Nothing was designed for this. And everyone's just going to have to chill out, basically. I mean, just, you know, I mean, every business, you know, will have this massive drop in profits or massive spike. And, you know, the explanation will be, well, the pandemic, you know, I don't know. I just...
And that's the introduction to the multi-million pound bid into UKRI from Wonky. It's basically 2020. I mean, we can't tell anything, but, you know, that's what I'd like to study, please. I'll have £500,000.
Christmas has come early for the HE Wonks this week, as OFS has published more consultations than I can even count. Jim, talk us through what is going on.
Yeah, so as well as this free speech university rankings surprise gift under the tree, we've also had a bunch of other gifts this week, certainly in England anyway, from the regulator, the Office for Students. A variety of outputs that were quite kind of exhausting to read. And although I managed to squeeze out, you know, a good 1500 words about a couple of aspects of them, you get to the end of them, you think there wasn't not a lot there. What's really going on here? And so, you know, for example, we got a rewrite of the document that sets out how OFS will monitor and intervene in higher education. And that was kind of interesting. One of the things that was built into the kind of original design of OFS and its regulatory framework was the idea that 5%, from memory, of registered providers would be randomly sampled every year, So, you know, they would be drawn out of the metaphorical hat in Nicholson House, and the kind of, you know, compliance or whatever they're called team would, you know, have a deep dive to try and work out, you know, what was going on in those institutions, whether they were compliant with the regulatory framework, to learn about those institutions and so on. That's gone in the name of bureaucracy reduction. We got some stuff on reportable events. These are the things that higher education institutions have to tell OFS about. And the press release headlined on what's called the notifications process, which is a process by which third parties, and the focus in the press release was students, can tell OFS things, not necessarily with a view to getting resolution, but just to tell OFS things. And look, you can certainly make the argument that says it's kind of a shame that we have replaced random sampling with a kind of big emphasis on notifications, which is basically if people happen to tell OFS stuff, if OFS thinks it's interesting in relation to its regulatory requirements, OFS will follow it up. But, you know, we don't know who would use it, why they would use that process. And it doesn't feel like a satisfactory replacement for, you know, kind of randomly sampling providers. Look, as I say, you get to the end of these documents, what's all this about? And I think it's about a couple of things. One of the things it's about is there's no doubt that various bits of the documents that have come out this week pick up technical issues with the critique of the regulator that came out of the court case involving Bloomsbury Institute and OFS's kind of general approach and some of its practices in developing its regulation and the initial registration of providers. Won't dwell on that too much. But what is kind of related to that is this wider issue that was actually the focus of a blog from the chief exec, Nicola Dandridge, about roughly the day before the pandemic hit. So almost the very last blog we ran on Wonky before big lockdown was a blog from Nicola, which was talking about broadly resetting the relationship between universities and the regulator in tonal terms to try and build a different kind of relationship. People have got very upset with the tone of lots of the documents. And that now, you can either argue that OFS needed in its first year 18 months to very clearly signal that it wasn't, you know, subject to producer capture, that it was different to HEFCE, that it was on the side of students rather than, you know, balancing its sides and so on, and that therefore it needed to be very robust in the first period. Or you can argue that some of the stuff that it put out was unnecessarily difficult, crunchy, antagonistic, and so on. I'm not really sure where I sit on that, although what I do hear is lots and lots of people in the sector that have gone very annoyed at things. But I mean, the one thing I'd say about all of this is there's something else I've read this week, which is actually from Ofsted, of all organisations, which is obviously a very different kind of regulator with very different kinds of powers and actually much more intrusive. But there's an Ofsted document floating around this week about the further education sector that is a run through of all of its engagement with further education providers during the pandemic. It's interesting. It's helpful. It reflects on the situation students find themselves in. It talks about the sort of support that leaders need. It's one of the most useful documents I've read on the tertiary education sector. And it couldn't be more different to this kind of fairly turgid technical stuff that is tumbling out of OFS for whatever reason.
Jonathan, that's really interesting. I know you work across the whole education landscape. Has there been a change in tone from Ofsted as well, or is what Jim describes quite unusual?
I mean, I think actually Ofsted always do a very good job at understanding this. Their sort of data and intelligence gathering function and what used to be called their thematic reports, I think, are really interesting. And of course, what's happened at the moment is that quite quietly, Ofsted has more or less amalgamated Ofqual since the exam fiasco in the summer. So you now have a super regulator in the sub 18 sector, looking at all elements of schoolwork. And of course, the other thing that's happened is that Ofsted has barely been able to be into schools this term, so it has a lot of additional capacity. So all of those things, I suspect, mean that it's got both more data and also more time and scope to be looking into these kind of things. So it was a good report and it was good to see, but I strongly suspect, sadly, that it's more an aberration than it is a consistency.
I don't think I've ever heard anyone on the Wonky Show wish that the OFS was more Ofsted-like.
just wait until we have an Ofsted for right. Universities.
Thank you, Mark. There's a pre-Christmas blog to do this evening.
Vivian, have you noticed the change in tone that was flagged earlier this year?
Well, I mean, not really. I mean, I've been arguing for a while that the OFS is just a teenage regulator, and it's going through its kind of slamming doors and shouting at you phase, and that eventually it will probably sort itself out. I also think, like many teenagers, it helps to be right, doesn't it? I mean, if you're going to stand in your in the sort of doorway of your bedroom hollering at your you know, whoever it is you're trying to influence, it would be helpful if you weren't kind of basically fundamentally wrong in some respects. And I think that's the thing that that surprises and disappoints me about some of the things that I read from OFS. And I have to say, I haven't read the latest batch of consultations. I really tried, but I thought that they were likely to be so boring that I played my nope card. I said, nope, I'm not going to read that. But I have been looking at the consultation they published on quality and standards, and it just makes you sort of slightly sad, I think, because it's a really important area, and there is, I think, you know, there is some fundamental absences in that which I think reveal I think an absence of quality in some of the things that the OFS puts out.
And look, the other thing that I would say is that what the documents this week have been kind of a part of is this process over the past couple of months of sort of relaunching the regulator, insofar as there's been this emphasis on, you know, the regulator as a risk-based regulator, and one that is concerned principally with the quality of outcomes from higher education rather than the actual higher education being provided itself. And you know, the people's expectations, I think, of OFS are often, you know, counter to those things in terms of, you know, what it looks at, what it's concerned about, and so on. The question is whether or not that can survive, or whether it will continue to jar, really. I mean, there was a moment a couple of weeks ago, OFS did this online event, and they'd got someone on that was reflecting on the relationship between companies in the kind of, you know, telecoms industry and Ofcom. And I was thinking, that was fascinating. You know, Ofcom doesn't wander around regulating telecoms in the industry and broadcasters on whether people feel cleverer as a result of what's happened, or whether people are happier, or whether people are economically more successful as a result of those industries. You know, they regulate on the actual things. Yeah. And it is going to continue, I think, to be really jarring for OFS, as I say, to focus on fairly relentlessly the outcomes from higher education rather than higher education itself. And I think the jury's out, particularly in this period where, in the end, I think, can you ask interesting questions about what it is the government is prepared to subsidise and what it isn't prepared to subsidise? So the question about, you know, funding of higher education. But should that be directly related to these questions about the regulation of higher education? In other words, you know, in the end, it's going to be a political judgment, isn't it, about what you fund, what you don't fund, the subjects and the people that you prioritise and the ones that you don't prioritise with your subsidy. And it feels like asking a regulator to do that rather than politicians doing it is generating a lot of confusion, some difficulty in terms of gap and overlap, and certainly a lot of confusion at best about expectations.
And if anyone can't face reading all of these documents, we've got handy summaries and analysis on wonky.com.
The year 2020 was awful at best. No help from the top, you were put to the test. Despite constant uncertainty, shifting goalposts, well, you've made it to Christmas, so let's raise a toast. With long days on Teams and no campus to go, it tested much more than your lateral flow. It's a real Christmas miracle that you pulled through, so we'd like to say thank you for all that you do. Wishing you Merry Christmas from Wonky to you.
So that's about it for this week. Remember to delve deeper into anything we've discussed today. You'll find links in the show notes. Don't forget, you can subscribe to the podcast automatically. Just search for The Wonky Show via Apple Podcasts or your favourite Android podcast directory. Or find the feed you need on wonky.com/podcast. And if you fancy appearing as a guest on The Wonky Show, drop us an email on team@wonky.com and we'll be in touch. So thanks to Vivian, Jonathan, Jim and everyone at Team Wonky for making it happen behind the scenes. And until next year, stay safe, stay wonky. See you then. Now for a musical interlude, or a different version of that.
And now for a musical interlude.
There's no correlate this week, but DK's here with a song. Or there's no correlate this week, but DK has thoughts of what he'd like for Christmas. Have you got enough there, Jim?
Yeah, I mean, any of those. I might use all of them.
There's a lot of bloopers. You'll hear it at the start. There's a lot of bloopers at the very start.